Have you ever slipped back into an old behavior after a period of being free of it? This is relapse, and we'll talk about its prevention in this edition of Recovery Support, a weekly podcast intended to support those in sexual recovery wherever you may be. Hi, and welcome to Recovery Support. I'm Kevin Bergen, licensed psychotherapist specializing in the recovery of men and women from porn addiction, sexually acting out, or any sexually compulsive behavior. The purpose of this podcast is to add support to your recovery with education, inspiration, and motivation. This week we're talking about relapse prevention. So many people in recovery experience some level of relapse, or they're really worried about it. Well, we're going to talk about some of the things you can do to prevent it today. And before we do so, as we usually do on the podcast, we're going to read a little bit from the White Book. The White Book is the handbook for Sexaholics Anonymous. And on page 203, we read about the problem. Many of us felt inadequate, unworthy, alone, and afraid. Our insides never matched what we saw on the outsides of others. Early on, we came to feel disconnected from parents, from peers, from ourselves. We tuned out with fantasy and masturbation. We plugged in by drinking in the pictures, the images, and pursuing the objects of our fantasies. We lusted and wanted to be lusted after. We became true addicts. Sex with self, promiscuity, adultery, dependency relationships, and more fantasy. We got it through the eyes. We bought it. We sold it. We traded it. We gave it away. We were addicted to the intrigue, the tease, the forbidden. The only way we knew to be free of it was to do it. "Please connect with me and make me whole," we cried with outstretched arms. Lusting after the big fix, we gave away our power to others. This produced guilt, self-hatred, remorse, emptiness, and pain, and we were driven ever inward, away from the reality, away from love, lost inside ourselves. Our habit made true intimacy impossible. We could never know real union with another because we were addicted to the unreal. We went for the chemistry, the connection that had the magic, because it bypassed intimacy and true union. Fantasy corrupted the real. Lust killed love. First addicts, then love cripples, we took from others to fill up what was lacking in ourselves, conning ourselves time and again that the next one would save us. We were really losing our lives. And that's the problem from the White Book, page 203. I'm going to jump right in this week, and we're going to talk about relapse prevention. I'm going to share some stories and some ideas taken largely from the book by Patrick Carnes called Don't Call It Love. I'm going to tell you about Shane. First of all, I'm going to change the names and the situations to protect anybody's confidentiality and anonymity. Shane, he was about 9 months into his recovery when he went on a business trip. It was a conference that he was attending in another state. When he left, he was feeling some anger and resentment toward his wife. And that all came because the night before he left, she was preoccupied and she didn't really want to have any sex before he left. And so he was really disappointed and he said, "I just wanted to have a special night with her before I left." And so he left resenting the fact that she didn't have sex with him. Now he also said, about the time when he left was that he was feeling a little too sure of himself in his recovery, and he thought that he could handle more without slipping. So he's at the conference, and he drinks at an after-conference cocktail party. This woman he starts talking to, and he ends up following her up to her room to see the view from the balcony. Well, he was confident that he wouldn't sleep with her, but he did. After that, he had lots of feelings of shame and guilt. When he got home, he went back to his SA meeting, and they helped him. They supported him. They helped him learn from this experience and not let despair send him back into a full relapse and start acting out again. They said that he hadn't given up his sobriety goal and that he can take credit for the months of sobriety that he'd actually had achieved. They said also that the pain that he was now feeling was a measure of his recovery. Previously, he had been pretty numb when he acted out, and now he was feeling some pain and he was feeling remorse for it, and that showed that he had made progress in his recovery. There were also those in his support system that were pretty hard on him. They pointed out that he had simply ignored his resentment for his wife before the trip. And they pointed out also that his old patterns of acting out had included scouting for women at conferences and how alcohol was commonly a factor when he acted out. He hadn't taken the steps necessary to prevent a slip. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous calls this problem of addiction cunning and baffling. And that refers to how addicts, even with good intentions, keep doing what they don't want to do. As addicts like Shane get some sobriety under their belt, they need to focus in three areas. First, they need to regroup and sort things out that they've learned in recovery. There's a lot of things we learn in recovery, and we need to focus on those and go back to them and apply them. So that's one of the first things. The second thing is to further strengthen your ability to avoid self-destructive behaviors. And then thirdly, you need to more clearly define your boundaries. Now, a sponsor's help is invaluable in all three of these areas, especially helping you set your boundaries and define them very clearly. This is what we refer to as relapse prevention. In AA, classic advice has been the acronym HALT, H-A-L-T. Never let yourself stay hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. This disease of addiction makes it necessary that each person in recovery define what is going to weaken your resolve to stay sober. For addictions like eating and sex, it becomes even more crucial that you pay attention to this whole notion of relapse prevention. Food and human contact are everywhere. Now, with alcohol, a slip is a drink, and it's pretty obvious when you've slipped, and it's very definable. Now, with food and sex, there's also a whole lot of mini slips. Those can lead to major slips. So this is why so many sex addicts who also have a chemical addiction say that sex addiction is tougher to recover from. There's more shades of gray in sex addiction because was this a slip, or was this leading to a slip, or is this a full relapse? And you have to be careful where you're headed. And so that leads to, what is relapse prevention? We're going to look at it in three stages, three components of relapse prevention. First of all, is to identify your triggers. Secondly, reduce your stress. And third, make strategies against slips. So let's talk about that first one, identifying your triggers. G. Allen Marriott, he's a pioneer in relapse prevention, and he coined this phrase that really talks to this idea about identifying your triggers. This phrase he talked about was apparently irrelevant decisions. Relapses begin with choices. When you make a choice, you're looking at the circumstances around the choice and the choice itself, and Marriott said that a lot of times they are apparently irrelevant decisions. Well, they are relevant. That's the problem. When an addict makes a decision, he doesn't always make sure that what's going on around him is relevant to a possible relapse and his continued sobriety. So you want to make sure that what's going on, you take good stock of and work with your therapist or you work with your sponsor. Here's a couple things that people have said about identifying their triggers. One guy said, overwork. I overdid it and depleted myself and got head over heels infatuated with somebody to fill me up. Another person said, prostitutes staring at me when I least expected it. I became totally helpless. That was his trigger. Somebody else said, an old lover invited me and I thought I could handle it. Another, I stayed in phone contact with one of my lovers. Another trigger that somebody mentioned said it this way, feeling depressed and isolated over financial matters, I received some porn material. I was still on their mailing list. Somebody else said, I started eating too much. This is always a clue that I'm in trouble. Another said, I went to a bookstore during idle time. In other words, he didn't have anything to do and he was bored and he went to a bookstore. That was a trigger that led him to acting out. And finally, somebody said, a major trigger has been being around my family. You need to identify what your triggers are. Patrick Carnes says, triggers are behaviors, rituals, conditions, and people who in some way activate the addictive pattern. Now, triggers can be very direct, like getting a call from an old girlfriend or finding porn in your mailbox or something like that. That's a very direct trigger. Some aren't as obvious as triggers. For instance, being depleted, emotionally overwhelmed. This can lead to feelings of entitlement. Feelings of entitlement say, you know what? I've worked really hard. I've stayed away from this stuff for pretty long. I deserve to be able to do this. That's what that can lead to. So look for the indirect as well as the direct triggers that can lead to relapse. Relapse prevention requires clarity about the triggers. Now let's talk about stress reduction. This is the second component in relapse prevention. Now, Ray Flannery, he was a Harvard psychologist who conducted this study. He studied people who respond to demanding situations without losing their sense of well-being. They were okay. He called these people stress-resistant people. He found four characteristics that described these people. First of all, they were people who sought solutions to challenges in their lives. In other words, they didn't wait for things to happen. Second, they were committed to some goal that added meaning to their life. Third, they made healthy lifestyle choices. Like, for instance, they would exercise regularly, or they used little or no alcohol or nicotine and caffeine. They relaxed. They used relaxation and meditation techniques. The fourth characteristic that describes these stress-resistant people is that they sought support from others. They were in supportive relationships. Now, these four characteristics really parallel closely the people that are in recovery and that prevent relapse. Dr. Carnes did a survey asking people, how did you learn to handle stress in your recovery? Here's what a couple of those people said. First person said, I found it very important during periods of high stress to keep in contact with my sponsor, therapist, and friends and talk about what's going on. I refuse to try to handle anything alone again. Meditation helps, but I have to make sure I don't stay isolated too much. Swimming has become an important activity for me too. The exercise is a great stress reducer. Somebody else in responding to this survey, how did they learn to handle stress? He said, knowing that almost all pain is memory of the past or worry about the future, I realize there's no pain in the now. Live in it. I meditate and sometimes feel free and almost joyful. My shame's probably not as bad as I think. And one more person said, being less serious sometimes and having fun. Learning positive self-talk. Affirmations. I look at matters I have to deal with as goals, not problems, and listing my goals. Being patient with myself and others. These are good ideas to help reduce stress. Now let's go on to the third component of relapse prevention. This is building strategies to prevent relapse. These strategies. One of the strategies that some therapists use is broken down into three phases. Here we are, we're enumerating a lot of things today. So here's another three count thing. First of all, a therapist will work with the addict and have them describe their perfect acting out fantasy. Well, maybe that's a trigger right in itself, but let me go on and describe why this is helpful. They figure out the scenarios that govern the addiction. Every addict's acting out is based on some kind of a script. And so by hearing what this perfect acting out fantasy would be, the therapist can then get some idea of the origins of this compulsivity. The destruction becomes clear about where this all comes from, and then he can work with that client and help him to therapeutically resolve that source of the addiction in the first place. The second phase of this strategy that therapists use is to have the addict imagine and then record what the consequences would be if that fantasy were going to be reality. They talk about all the different possibilities of consequences. Now, when they do this, the addict starts to contaminate or spoil the fantasy. Addicts don't typically link their fantasies to consequences, and by linking it, it reduces both the power of the fantasy itself and it reduces the vulnerability to have a relapse again. The third phase of this strategy for therapists is to have the addict think about what they'll do if a slip does occur. What's the plan of action? Have something ready to do. Once a slip starts to slip up, he's likely to say something like, well, I've gone this far, I might as well go all the way. And so a binge can turn into a whole return to the addictive life. Now, with this kind of exit strategy, they can prevent this downward spiral, and they can do something against it. And sometimes this is in the form of a contract with the therapist or a sponsor, so that when they start to slip, they can recognize it, and they can go back and follow this contract they've done or some other kind of strategy that they've set up. When you start to slip and you realize it, take these steps. So here's some ideas that addicts who actually did slip, that had some level of relapse, said was helpful for them to help them actually keep it from turning into a full-blown relapse and lose more of their sobriety. One person said, I took on a lot of SA tasks. I made a list of reasons not to act out, and I carried them around in my wallet. Somebody else said, sharing immediately with my group was absolutely critical. Another person said, I used my relapse as a red flag that something wasn't quite right in my life. With my group, I figured out needs I had not identified and worked on. So here's some ideas I've shared that help give you an idea of what you can do to prevent any kind of relapse from happening before it happens. Also, to help you when relapse does occur. Lastly, I'm going to go over a few items that Dr. Carnes lists as addicts' best advice to resist addictive cravings. First of all, develop spiritual strategies. He says yoga, meditation, prayer, whatever strategies help you connect with yourself and the rhythm of the universe, need to be deepened, strengthened, and practiced. Number one on almost everyone's list is the development of a spiritual base, a calm center. This helps you resist turmoil. Another item, decode feelings. What does decode feelings mean? Okay, he says, sex that's about addiction and not sexuality is usually accompanied by feelings of shame, loneliness, fear, pain, or anger. Always check for these feelings. Remember that to act out a feeling sexually doesn't resolve the feeling. If you can't decode your feelings, get with a sponsor or a therapist or other group members. Another suggestion for resisting addictive cravings, avoid trigger situations. Okay, that's one of the main parts and components of relapse prevention for us. So avoiding trigger situations is about identifying the situation, the persons, the circumstances, any of those things that can trigger addictive responses. Respect your powerlessness. Avoid triggers. When in doubt, don't. Then another point, forgive yourself for slips. If a slip occurs, turn it into a learning experience. Be gentle with yourself. Your shame will cause you to beat up on yourself, which will make you even more vulnerable. Next point, work on nurturing yourself. Exercise, walk, eat well, rest. Get massages, baths, safe indulgences, safe ones. Seek out nature, music, art, humor. Get with good friends. Take time to take care of yourself. Make your living space a place that you're comfortable and that you feel safe so that you can transform yourself into the healthy sobriety that you want. Another point, avoid keeping cravings secret. This is really important here. When you keep your cravings secret, it'll add to their power. When you feel like acting out, go to people you trust so that you're not alone. In general, secrets are about shame. Shame always makes you more vulnerable. Secrets separate you from other people in recovery. Find alternative passions. Things like hobbies, sports, different activities that you really enjoy. Cultivate these parts of your life so compulsive patterns in working, obsessing, or acting out have to compete with activities and interests that are actually rewarding. Alternative passions become new areas where you can grow. And lastly, this is another suggestion to resist addictive cravings. Acknowledge your choices. Avoid the feeling that you're a victim. You are powerless about your addiction, but you are in charge of your program of recovery and your lifestyle. In most areas, you have choices. They can help you achieve the balance that you want in your life. Be proactive instead of reactive by being able to acknowledge to yourself and to other people what your choices are. So that wraps up the three areas of relapse prevention. One, identify your triggers. Two, reduce your stress. And three, make strategies to prevent slips. In closing, I'm going to read again from the White Book, this time page 204, The Solution. We saw that our problem was threefold: physical, emotional, and spiritual. Healing had to come about in all three. The crucial change in attitude began when we admitted we were powerless, that our habit had us whipped. We came to meetings and withdrew from our habit. For some, this meant no sex with themselves or others, including not getting into relationships. For others, it also meant drying out and not having sex with a spouse for a time to recover from lust. We discovered that we could stop, that not feeding the hunger didn't kill us, that sex was indeed optional. There was hope for freedom, and we began to feel alive, encouraged to continue. We turned more and more away from our isolating obsession with sex and self, and turned to God and others. All this was scary. We couldn't see the path ahead, except that others had gone the way before. Each new step of surrender felt it would be off the edge into oblivion, but we took it. And instead of killing us, surrender was killing the obsession. We had stepped into the light, into a whole new way of life. The fellowship gave us monitoring and support to keep us from being overwhelmed, a safe haven where we could finally face ourselves. Instead of covering our feelings with compulsive sex, we began exposing the roots of our spiritual emptiness and hunger, and the healing began. As we faced our defects, we became willing to change. Surrendering them broke the power they had over us. We began to be more comfortable with ourselves and others for the first time without our drug. Forgiving all who had injured us, and without injuring others, we tried to right our own wrongs. At each amends, more of the dreadful load of guilt dropped from our shoulders until we could lift our heads, look the world in the eye, and stand free. We began practicing a positive sobriety, taking the actions of love to improve our relationships with others. We were learning how to give, and the measure we gave was the measure we got back. We were finding that none of the substitutes had ever supplied. We were making the real connection. We were home. I'm going to close today with a third step prayer found on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. Thanks for being with me today on Recovery Support. Some of you have asked if you could contribute to the cause of Recovery Support, and the answer is yes. If you'd like to donate something toward the expense of this podcast in the spirit of the seventh tradition, you can donate anonymously via PayPal through the link on the show notes page. To see notes for this program and for other programs, which books I've recommended, and other ideas, see the show notes at recoverysupport.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. Thanks so much for being with me on this episode of Recovery Support. I look forward to being with you next week. Until then, have a sober day.